This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. KDLL, Kenai Soldotna, 91.9 FM. I'm Jenny Nyman, and let's talk fish, shall we? It's not prime fishing season, but salmon, of course, are important to us here on the Kenai Peninsula all year round. So this hour, we're going to take the temperature of our watershed. Kenai Peninsula College hosted a two-part series of presentations on the potential effects of climate change on the future of fish and fishing and wildlife and hunting on the Kenai Peninsula. The first presentation was December 2nd, focused on fish, followed by part two on wildlife and hunting on December 9th. There's lots more to hear than we have time to share. So if you want to listen to the entire presentation, check out Kenai Peninsula College on Facebook and go to their events page. Going to hear from the scientists today. We've got Dr. Eric Shane, fisheries biologist with the University of Alaska Fairbanks, followed by Sue Mauger, science and executive director with Cook Inlet Keeper. Here's Eric.
I'm Eric Shane. I'm a fisheries biologist at UAF. And I've been studying climate change, particularly how it relates to Alaskan salmon for the last couple of years. Yeah, so I'm going to talk today about just kind of a brief overview of some of the recent science on what climate change means for Alaskan salmon, in particular Cook Inlet and Kenai salmon, and talk a little bit about our fisheries. Like I said, I'm a fisheries biologist at the Institute of Arctic Biology here at UAF. And I'll start out by briefly summarizing some findings from a study we wrote a couple of years ago focusing on the Kenai River. It's just a really special watershed, extraordinarily productive and diverse, sports world-class fisheries. Obviously, there have been a lot of challenges in recent years, challenges as far as smaller fish, fewer fish, fisheries closures. So these are still extremely productive runs when you look at them across, you know, compared to runs across the world. Huge, it's just a tremendous resource, even considering these recent challenges. But it, you know, has prompted a lot of people to wonder, are these really extraordinarily valuable salmon runs and are fisheries resilient to climate change? And if not, what can we do to help them become more resilient? Or what can we do not to make things worse? So just real briefly, Alaska has warmed at more than twice the rate of the rest of the US over the past 60 years. So the Arctic in general and Alaska in particular is just warming at a tremendous rate. In the Kenai River watershed in particular, National Weather Service records, we've seen rapidly warming air temperatures during all seasons, especially winter. We've seen drier summers and wetter falls. And climate projections from UAF predict that the warming is going to continue or accelerate in the future. So it's not slowing down. We don't really know what's going to happen with precipitation. Models have different predictions on that. But we might expect these changes to be felt differently depending where you are in the landscape. The Kenai River watershed, I'm sure everybody knows this, but you know, it flows from these high glaciated mountains in the east through the main stem down to lowlands in the west where it drains into Cook Inlet. And salmon live throughout the watershed in these just remarkably different habitats. So these top three photos are juvenile coho and chinook in Beaver Creek in the Kenai lowlands. That's the left picture. The Russian River up in the mountains, and then Ptarmigan Creek, which drains a glacially influenced basin into Kenai Lake. We have obviously big glacial rivers on the Kenai and throughout Alaska. So this is the Resurrection River. These rivers tend to be thought of mainly as migration corridors for salmon. They're too silty and the banks are too unstable to provide a lot of food. Although we found evidence that salmon actually can make a living under certain conditions in rivers like this, like the Susitna. But typically these are, you know, lower productivity rivers compared to the clear water streams. But then the Kenai River main salmon, rivers flowing out of glacial lakes in general, can be extremely productive and pretty special resources because these rivers tend to have late runs of salmon. So the late sockeye and king runs in the Kenai, they spawn and rear in the main stem below these huge lakes, Kenai Lake and Skelak Lake. And that, because salmon are available, there's an early run and a late run that makes salmon more available to people and to the other animals that eat them. And we might expect all these different types of habitats to respond differently to climate change. So like in a super hot, dry year, a lowland stream fed by wetlands might get really hot and might dry up. Whereas a big glacial river might actually, the water level is going to come up because the glacier is melting faster. It might get more silty. So we might expect that basically the landscape to filter this signal from climate change and have different effects on salmon in different places. So if the climate models are right, which of course they're not, but it's gives us an interesting way to think about the future, some scenarios, what would we expect to happen to juvenile salmon growth? Warming, it indeed did have diverse effects across the landscape. However, once you get 60 years out, most of those effects are negative. So salmon, they've gotten past, it's warmed up past the optimal temperature for growth, and now it's starting to get a little bit too hot. So in general, that, you know, there was predicted there would be some beneficial effects of these temperatures, but mostly negative effects. Okay, so that's the effects of climate per se. Also, like I said, there's these massive landscape changes happening. So drying wetlands. The wetlands in the Kenai lowlands have shrunk dramatically since the 1950s. This is data from Ed Berg from the Kenai Refuge. We're seeing much more frequent wildfires. So wildfires are becoming more common and the area burned is becoming larger each year. And then human development is obviously affecting the landscape as well. So we looked at aerial photos and we found that the footprint of human development has expanded more than 20 times since the 1950s in the Kenai River watershed overall. And obviously, if you live there, you know this already, but the development's concentrated right along the lower Kenai River within a kilometer of the river, and that lower river is key habitat for late run kings. I guess a naive take on this might be, well, development is threatening fish, but maybe a glass half full take would be that, wow, we have this phenomenal salmon run that's flows right through two of our cities. So I think that's pretty cool. It just means we have to take care for how we treat that habitat. It's a really important habitat. So obviously glaciers are retreating really fast. The Skelak Glacier, and the Skelak, obviously, it drains into the Kenai River, into Skelak Lake, and into the Kenai River. So one of the biggest sources of water of the Kenai. So up to the late 70s, the glacier thinned quite a bit, but it didn't retreat very much. And then all of a sudden, it retreated fast, and it created this new proglacial lake at the toe of Skelak Glacier. And this is happening, obviously, throughout the world, and in Alaska, this is happening at a tremendous rate. Exit glaciers retreated a whole bunch. You can, you know, hike that trail and see the signs, how far it used to extend 100 years ago. So those are the easy things to see, to visualize this retreat. But I think thinning is actually more dramatic to me. So the Harding Ice Field in the last half of the 20th century thinned by 30 meters. So picture 100 feet of ice. So like taller than the tallest buildings in Anchorage. That much ice is gone across the Harding Ice Field. So it's just a tremendous loss of ice. And this graph here shows the USGS has been actually quantifying this on Wolverine Glacier, which is in the eastern Kenai. And just since the 90s, year after year, big drops in the amount of ice. So what does that mean for salmon though? So in general, having glacial input into a river is going to buffer the river from really hot, dry weather, like I mentioned earlier. So if the glacier goes away completely, you're going to lose that buffering capacity, and that's a risk to salmon. So there's also opportunities, though, by melting glaciers. So a lot of Alaska is covered with ice. There's no salmon living there, obviously. So as the glaciers retreat, we might expect new habitats to be formed, and we do see that. So in the Copper River Basin, Fish and Game, they see, they do aerial surveys, they see king salmon nosing up against the ice of the toe of some glaciers where last year that was just ice. So they're exploring these new habitats all the time, and they will colonize it. So these are some dramatic examples of potential risks and potential opportunities from glaciers melting on the Kenai in particular. I mean, Harding Ice Field's not going away anytime soon. We could certainly see changes in the amount of glacial runoff flowing into the Kenai. And maybe to think about an opportunity, we've thought about the Snow River, so flowing into Upper Kenai Lake at the start of the Lost Lake Trail there. That river currently, it has some salmon in it, has some coho and probably some other species, but not very many. It's just too glacial. It's the banks are unstable. It's not very good habitat. But as the glaciers retreat in that basin, if it remains undeveloped, the valley is really wide. There's room for a meandering river. So we might in the future expect to see that become a more productive part of the Kenai habitat portfolio. Just speculation there, but there's potential for opportunities close to home. Okay, so how are all these changes affect salmon? So just a template here on salmon populations. They're super variable, clearly. So here I've plotted data from the Kenai early and late run kings, and then Kenai and Russian early and late run sockeye. So five different runs that Fish and Game's monitored for 3 to 4 years. And all of these stocks have fluctuated. Their numbers, spawning abundance has fluctuated by tenfold over this time period. So massive differences. And they're plotted on a log scale here. So it's compressed. It doesn't look as dramatic, but massive differences from the worst year to the best year. But if we look back further, there's actually even bigger differences. So Molly McCarthy works for Fish and Game now in Anchorage. She was a master's student working on the Kenai with Alan Boras. And she did some really cool sediment coring work. She drilled sediment cores in Upper Russian Lake. And she found that over the past 4,000 years, by looking at the chemistry in the layers of lake sediments, she found that there were even bigger multi-century fluctuations in Upper Russian Lake sockeye. That's the early run. And those seem to mirror fluctuations that have been seen in Kodiak sockeye as well, linked to large-scale climate effects. So we have, you know, year-to-year variation, then we have maybe a good decade and a bad decade, like Brent was talking about earlier. And then going back thousands of years, you have a good century and a bad century. So that's been happening since, you know, before human-induced climate change. That's the template that we're working on top of here. And then when people have tried to link these fluctuations to climate, sometimes you see climatic effects. Usually not all of the variability is explained by climate. There's a lot of other things going on, obviously. And we'll talk in detail about how climate, our research on climate effects on Cook Inlet kings in just a few minutes. But just another note about climate and the landscape and salmon fluctuations. There's this foundational concept in the scientific literature now coming from Daniel Schindler's group at the University of Washington, this idea of the portfolio effect. So salmon runs, they fluctuate a lot, they go up and down. But if you have intact, diverse landscapes, like the Kenai is the prime example of this, all these different kinds of habitats that are producing salmon, some are going to do well in 1 year, some are going to do well in a different year, and they're going to balance things out, and they're going to, in aggregate, at the mouth of the river, the number of fish swimming in is going to be more stable over time than in fragmented homogeneous landscapes like the Columbia River Basin, where there's, dams and all kinds of development. So if we can maintain diverse landscapes and keep all the options open for salmon, even in places like the Snow River that aren't big producers right now, even in places like those lowland streams like Beaver Creek, right in Soldotna there, Slycock Creek by KPC, it's possible in future years there'll be a big run that comes in due to changing conditions. And we can't always predict that, but if we keep the habitats available, the fish, it gives the fish a lot of options. So now I'm gonna focus on a little bit more detail on, get a little bit nerdy here on how climate affects kings in Cook Inlet. So this is a paper that we published this summer. Is a big collaborative team led by UAA and UAF. And we had players from APU, Sue from Cook Inlet Keeper, who we'll be talking next, was a key player, and then collaborators at the Fish and Wildlife Service and ADF&G. So basically Chinook salmon populations throughout Alaska, especially Cook Inlet, or not especially Cook Inlet, but including Cook Inlet, have declined markedly in the last decade and a half or so. The environment's been changing rapidly. So ocean conditions have been changing, including climate, competition with hatchery salmon, predation in the ocean, potentially bycatch, and freshwater conditions have been changing really rapidly. Spawning abundance changes every year. Stream temperatures have been warming, changes in precipitation, invasive species, human development. So all these factors affect the Chinook life cycle. I realize these are coho in the picture, but I just love this little life cycle graphic, so bear with me. And there's this prominent viewpoint among the general public and among some scientists that salmon declines are due to problems in the ocean. And I think, I guess, clearly that in part that's true. The ocean obviously causes salmon runs to go up and down. However, I think this has maybe been misinterpreted or taken a little too far to exclude the importance of freshwater. So in this study, we were asking, so we know, we took it for granted, it's been shown, clearly the ocean, changes in the ocean clearly affect ups and downs in salmon runs, including Alaskan Chinook. That's non-controversial. But can we really rule out these freshwater processes as important drivers? Is there evidence that freshwater matters too in Alaska? Or is it, you know, maybe it really is just mainly driven by ocean climate? So in our study, we were looking at climatic drivers. In particular, we focused on ocean climate and then these climatic drivers in freshwater, including stream temperature and precipitation and other things like ice river breakup timing in the spring and in spawning abundance. So to get back to this landscape cartoon, we have climate change happening globally. These changes in air temperature and precipitation are felt differently in different local habitats. But previous studies haven't had local data to test for the effects of these freshwater changes on salmon. So typical studies looking at freshwater and marine drivers of salmon populations in Alaska, they haven't had stream temperature data from the streams in their study. So they take air temperature data from one airport, and they might take precipitation data, or they might have one gauged stream in the study area. So they use that as a proxy for all the streams in the study area. But like we've been saying, these streams they're responding differently to climate change. So we thought that we might be missing the importance of these freshwater signals by looking at these regional proxies rather than looking at the actual local freshwater habitat conditions. So our objective here was to quantify how do environmental conditions relate to the productivity of king salmon runs in Cook Inlet. We looked at 15 populations that where Fish and Game had done long-term monitoring and where Cook Inlet Keeper, led by Sue, had done long-term stream temperature monitoring. Those were kind of our two most limiting data sets. And these were the 15 where we had enough data of both types to analyze. And you'll see, so we have them color-coded on the map by spawning abundance. The Kenai is number one, and Cook Inlet, the Deshka is number two. And we'll focus on those a little bit. But we had five on the Kenai Peninsula, so the Anchor, Crooked, Nanilchik, and Deep Creek. And when we say Kenai here, we only looked at the Kenai late run because the Kenai early run spawns in a bunch of different tribs and they all have different conditions. So we weren't able to quantify the local, we couldn't single out the local environmental conditions because that run is composed of a bunch of different spawning populations. So we had three steps basically. What were the environmental conditions that each population experienced in each brood year. So that's the year when the parent salmon spawn and the eggs are in the gravel. How has the productivity of each population changed over time? And then putting that together, how were the environmental conditions correlated with productivity? So what, when salmon did really well, what was it like that year? And how, you know, did that vary among these different rivers, or was it the same across the board? So step one, we looked at a bunch of different environmental conditions. So some regional things, including river ice breakup timing, which tends to be correlated, really strongly correlated across space. So you can pretty well easily use a proxy from one river. And that's, if it's a late breakup year in the Susitna, it's a late breakup year across South Central. Ocean conditions. So we had one index of ocean conditions called the North Pacific Gyre Oscillation, which has been shown to be strongly correlated with Chinook productivity across the North Pacific. So this is a really important one, but admittedly, ocean conditions were not our focus here. And then we looked at a bunch of local watershed specific drivers. So precipitation, how much did it rain in the watershed? And we were able to get these data specifically for each watershed based on downscale climate models. That this is work that happens at UAF. And then stream temperature data. And this was only possible because of Sue Mauger and her team's foresight to start measuring stream temperature throughout Cook Inlet quite a while ago. And she'll tell you more about that in a few minutes. But we used her fairly long-term data set, and then our colleagues were able to hindcast that back in time using airport data and the unique stream-specific relationship between air temperature and stream temperature. So salmon runs. This was kind of my wheelhouse on the project. We compiled data from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game on spawning abundance, harvest, and age composition of the escapement and harvest. We filled in missing age composition data using some statistical models. We excluded hatchery fish across the board, even though, so some of these runs like Crooked Creek are hatchery enhanced, and we only used data where they specifically reported separately for hatchery and wild, and we didn't include the hatchery fish to avoid confounding things. And then we estimated this index of productivity. So it was based on brood years, so the year that the adults spawned. So for when the salmon, you know, met up in the riverbed and they spawned, how many offspring did they produce that survived to come back as adults and either be harvested in the fishery or spawn themselves? So it was, this is a relative index. It's based on log recruits per spawner, but it's not an absolute number for each river. It was just relative. And on these graphs, I'm showing you one little graph here for the Kenai late run. So higher numbers are better. Zero is average for that river. And lower numbers are worse. So you can see it just jumps out at you that Kenai late run was super productive in the 1990s, the broods of the 1990s, and then huge crash in productivity. And there were these five really weak brood years from 2003 to 2007. And again, you have to think, so this isn't, there were a lot of fish, people caught a lot of fish in these years. Those were the adults. But those adults, when they spawned, their offspring didn't produce very many surviving offspring in future years. So, okay, this is a Kenai. Now, this can make your eyes cross, but this is all 15 of the populations. Don't worry about the details, but the take-home message, look at those gray bands. So between 2003 and 2007, 13 of these 15 populations had their lowest productivity levels. And those are just really low productivity years across the board. Major decrease in productivity during those 5 years. And then things rebounded somewhat. And then after our data set ended, but you know, new data has come in since we did the analysis, things went back down. But what was going on in those 5 years? So how did the environmental conditions correlate with the productivity? So the biggest effect we saw was fall rains. So Chinook were much less productive across the board, every stream in the region, when they experienced heavy rains during and after spawning. So that's the biggest take-home message here. Heavy fall rains are bad for the egg. I mean, the eggs are in the gravel. They can get smothered by sediment. They can get washed away if the river floods and the gravel moves. And salmon biologists from other regions will recognize this is really common. It just hadn't been shown very often in Alaska because we've lacked this watershed specific data. Chinook were more productive, somewhat more productive, when they experienced moderate rains during juvenile rearing. So during their juvenile phase, they spend 1 year in freshwater. Having a drought or a flood is bad when you're juvenile in the river. Having moderate rains was good. And Chinook were also less productive when it was really hot in the river during spawning. So when weekly high temperatures exceeded 18 degrees C or 64 degrees F, we saw a big drop off in productivity. And that happened to coincide with the worst of those 5 years. So put it all together, we saw evidence for cumulative effects. So there was no one smoking gun, but there was this combination of bad conditions, mostly in freshwater, although marine conditions had an effect as well. But we saw those during those 5 years, that was mainly explained by heavy fall rains during a couple of the years, and then really hot summer temperatures, hot and dry during other years. There also happened to be really high spawning abundances during some of those years. So we can't disentangle that from temperature very well, but it's clearly that if there's a lot of spawners in the river and it's super hot, that was really bad. We can't necessarily completely disentangle those. So some caveats here. These are correlations. Correlation is not causation. These could be spurious statistical effects. However, by looking across 15 populations, and in the cases, each of the cases I mentioned, we found pretty strong coherence across these populations. It's a lot less likely that could just be due to chance. These are statistical effects. We need field research to understand the mechanisms. And I'll get into that in just a sec as far as temperature. Also, the model explained only some of the ups and downs. There's a lot of variation that was unexplained. So obviously there's other important factors like marine heat waves, competition in the ocean, clearly very important. And in one of our study streams, Alexander Creek, invasive pike predation has caused that population to collapse. So we didn't have pike abundance numbers for most of our streams, so we couldn't include that as a driver in our study, but clearly that's a big factor in Alexander Creek and potentially in a few of the other streams it might have an effect as well. So put it all together, the big conclusion was that adverse freshwater conditions likely contributed to the declines of king salmon in the Cook Inlet region. And interestingly, since this is a Kenai audience, I expected the Kenai River to be different because, like I said, it's flowing out of this big glacial lake, and flows are stabilized by the glacial input. In a hot year, the flows go up instead of down. The biggest floods in the Kenai River don't come from heavy rains. They come from glacial outburst events up in the mountains that caused the river to come way up. So I expected the Kenai to be an outlier, but it wasn't. And in particular, heavy fall rains were really, you know, just as harmful in the Kenai as they were everywhere else. So that is really intriguing. And I think there's a couple possibilities, but maybe it's not the flows causing the gravel to move in the Kenai, but maybe it's washing in sediments from the side streams. And I've heard that the river will turn brown after really big rain events. So maybe it's not necessarily the flow, but it's the sediment. Also, a lot of really good research coming out of Puget Sound has shown after a big rain event in the Seattle metro area, you get tons of dead pre-spawn mortality of coho salmon if they happen to be in the streams at that time, because heavy metals and copper and a lot of nasty stuff washes off of the roads into the streams. And that is possible, since the Kenai is in a urbanized area, it's possible that's a factor there. I haven't seen any data specifically on that for the Kenai, but it's worth considering. And we'll talk about that in a sec. Okay, so that was that's what we found in this study. But what can we do about it? So we care about salmon. We don't want our salmon to go away. What can we do as Alaskans to give our salmon a better chance to make it when there's bad environmental conditions, and maybe a better chance to capitalize if there's good environmental conditions and have a really good run? The cool thing about it is, even though these are climatically driven, a lot of these factors, as Alaskans, we can't control the global CO2 emissions all by ourselves. So that can feel a little bit hopeless. But there's a lot we can do at the local level to give salmon a better chance to handle these conditions. So things like heavy rains, maintaining strong riparian buffers can have a huge effect by filtering out sediment and pollution from urban areas before it can reach the stream. Culvert replacement, preventing high flows from washing over culverts. Green stormwater infrastructure to filter that urban runoff before it reaches the stream. These have all been shown to be effective in other places. High temperatures, restoring riparian vegetation, like has been done on the Russian River, down by the confluence there. And it is being done on the Kenai River main stem as well. If you have more trees shading the river, you're going to have, it could be a hot, dry summer, but the river water won't get quite as hot. So we can help salmon out that way too. And finding cool water refuge habitats, and I won't talk much about this because this is Sue's expertise and she'll give you a lot more information on this, but this is another really cool thing we can do at a local level to give salmon a better chance to persist. So I'm just going to talk briefly about some research by a couple of colleagues. So another paper came out right after ours this summer that took a totally different approach. They're looking at effects of heat stress on kings in the Yukon River. And they were looking at genetic and protein biomarkers of heat stress. So we were looking at population dynamics. So this completely different approach, different system. We're both studying Alaskan king salmon. But they also found this 18 degree C or 64 degree F threshold, where all of a sudden, you know, things can get warmer and warmer without much effect. But once you get above 18 degrees C or 64 degrees F, all of a sudden they saw this highly elevated heat stress response in king salmon. And they showed that those conditions occur almost every year in the Yukon River mainstem, even, you know, so far north. We think of that, it must be pretty cold, but the Yukon River mainstem actually gets about the same temperature as the Fraser River mainstem down in Vancouver, BC. So it gets, I mean, it's a huge river. The interior Alaska gets hot. That river soaks up a lot of heat. So Vanessa von Biela led this group, a big collaborative group, and she and her team concluded that warming water temperatures are currently affecting Yukon River king salmon. And then most recently, so last year, we had this huge heat wave and drought, and it caused salmon die-offs across Alaska. And this was just really shocking and unprecedented in a lot of ways. So this picture on the right is a creek in Prince William Sound. There were thousands and thousands of dead pink salmon found all over the place in Prince William Sound because the creeks were literally dry. So the salmon would move, the marine water was warm. So they're moving up into the creek at high tide, and then the tide goes out and there's no water in the creek and they just end up dying. And the picture on the bottom left is from Stephanie Quinn Davidson. These are chum salmon that were found dead in the Koyukuk River, a tributary of the Yukon. So quite far north. They hadn't spawned yet. You can see the eggs in the milt sacs there haven't spawned. So this is pre-spawn mortality. And these, again, Vanessa von Biela, USGS, has been compiling these observations, and they range across almost the entire state. And they cover all five species of Pacific salmon, plus other salmonids as well. So this heat wave and this drought last year was a really big deal. And it opened a lot of people's eyes that, whoa, this, you know, we're way up north, we're an Arctic state, but the water is already high enough to the temperatures are already high enough to kill salmon here during a hot year. So, okay, we talked about effects of climate on fish, and I'm about done. Before I wrap it up, I just want to briefly touch on fishing and fishing revenues in particular. So salmon populations go up and down. And that makes fishing a boom and bust industry. That's hard. It's hard to not know how much, you know, how well your business is going to do from one year to the next. And it's hard for fishing communities where a big part of the local economy is based on a single resource that can fluctuate tenfold from one year to the next. So there's been a fair bit of research now showing that fishing communities that participate in more diverse fisheries, so they're targeting different species and different stocks, they enjoy more stable revenues over time. So that makes sense. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. This has been shown across Alaska, and we showed it within the Kenai Peninsula in particular. However, unfortunately, most fishing communities on the Kenai have actually become more specialized over time. So they're not, our communities haven't been diversifying, they've been specializing. On the northern Kenai, I mean, sockeye is huge, especially in the commercial fleet. There used to be more diverse harvest of a wider variety of salmon species, and now it's become much more focused on sockeye. And this specialization, putting all our eggs in one basket, could reduce our economic resilience to major changes like climatic regime shifts. Or in this case, because kings and reds run at the same time, a downturn in kings can shut down the sockeye fishery. So it's a very fragile system. It's a hard problem. Obviously, sockeye is a super valuable resource. It's not easy to just say, oh, we should catch more pinks or, you know, something else. Obviously, you know, and our fishing fleet is fairly specialized, and it's true, you know, as well for the sport fisheries. But the sport fisheries have diversified quite a bit to focus on other species other than kings during the king downturn. So I think it's an important question to ask as policymakers, government leaders, community members, people who fish, how can we promote diversification and flexibility in our fishing communities so that somehow build flexibility into the governance so people aren't locked in with, say, quota where they can only target one stock, where they maybe fishers could have more flexibility to harvest what's available in any given year. Hard questions, but I think worth addressing. So take-home messages. As Alaskans, we have local control over many of the factors influencing our future salmon runs. So the climate is changing really rapidly. It should be cause for concern. It's a really big deal. It's already affecting our salmon, but it's not all negative. The salmon are not all gonna die because of climate change anytime soon. There's gonna be new opportunities, and we have the chance to, through our actions and our habitat conservation decisions, we have a chance to help salmon do better given the changing climate. In particular, maintaining a diversity of options, so strong habitat protections, as well as economic diversity, may allow salmon runs and fishing communities to continue to thrive in the face of change.